From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Israel is condemned over the deadly shelling of a UN school. Amid reports, the IDF was given multiple warnings the building was housing refugees.
When these people are advised that their areas are in danger of being bombed, they have very little choice. It's not as if they can leave Gaza. That's not an option.
Also today, we look at China's anti-corruption drive as another high-profile figure is dragged into the ongoing probe. And the last remaining crew member of the Enola Gay bomber, Theodore Van Kirk, dies age 93.
We were told by the scientists very early on that we would have to be 9 miles away from the bomb when it exploded, or it might take the airplane with it. So we were working very hard to be at least 9 miles away.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. The United Nations says the Israeli army is to blame for the shelling of a school in Gaza that killed 15 people. The UN estimates nearly 1,200 Palestinians have died and more than 6,200 been injured since the conflict began, with a child killed every hour. From FSN's bureau at the UN in New York, Nick Harper reports.
The UN says all indicators suggest Israeli artillery was to blame for the hit on a UN-run school where civilians were sheltering. It's now the 133rd school that has been shelled in 3 weeks of fighting. And the very young are bearing the brunt, here's UN Director for Humanitarian Affairs John Ging.
21% of those casualties are indeed children. 249 children have lost their lives so far. So every hour that this conflict goes on, another innocent child is killed.
So far, 58 Israelis, mainly soldiers, have been killed. Nick Harper, New York.
In Gaza itself, at least 17 Palestinians were killed on Wednesday in an Israeli strike on a fruit and vegetable market. That attack came during what was supposed to be a four-hour truce. Israel says three more of its soldiers were killed in Gaza, and its air force has been dropping leaflets warning residents of upcoming attacks. Christian Aid's policy and advocacy officer William Bell says those warnings are not especially helpful.
There really isn't anywhere particularly safe for these people to go. And I think what we've seen over the last few weeks is that actually nowhere is safe. I think that's really the important point to remember, that when these people are advised that their areas are in danger of being bombed, they have very little choice as to where to go. It's not as if they can leave Gaza. That's not an option.
In other news, a Malaysian delegation is in the Netherlands for talks with the Dutch government nearly 2 weeks after the Malaysian Airlines disaster. Prime Minister Najib Razak will join the talks on Thursday. FSN's Natalie Powell is in Amsterdam.
Now, the Ministry of Health is hoping that they are able to speed up the identification process for the victims of flight MH17 by offering further assistance to the Dutch forensic teams. Now, at the moment, we know there are around 21 Malaysian medical experts aiding the Dutch investigators. But one of the main focus points for the Health Ministry of Malaysia is to try to ensure that the repatriation process for the Malaysian victims of flight MH17 takes place as quickly as possible.
The Islamist group Boko Haram is being blamed for a suicide attack at a college in northern Nigeria. At least six people were killed. A suicide bomber blew herself up in a crowd of students waiting to check their names on an admission list. It was the fifth attack in the northern region of Kano since last weekend. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The British government has held an emergency national security meeting to discuss the threat it says the Ebola virus poses to the UK. The Cobra meeting came after several airlines in West Africa grounded flights to Liberia and Sierra Leone amid concerns about the disease's spread. More than 670 people have died after contracting the virus in West Africa. And while no one in Britain has been affected so far, and there are no reported cases of Ebola in the country, Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond says it's important for the government to be prepared.
The issue is about the possibility of somebody who has contracted the disease in Africa getting sick here. It is not about the disease spreading in the UK, because we have, frankly, different standards of infection control procedure that would make that most unlikely.
The US Commerce Department says America's economy grew at an annual rate of 4% in the second quarter of the year. It follows a disappointing gross domestic product report in the first quarter as the cold weather took its toll on the US economy. From FSN's business desk in New York, William Denzelow reports.
Thanks largely to strong consumer and business spending, the US economy has reversed the losses suffered in the first few months of the year. Consumer spending, which accounts for roughly two-thirds of the US economy, was up at 2.5% in the second quarter, with many people spending more money on large items like cars and trucks. The economy's contraction in the first quarter was also revised to 2.1%, with the cold weather and a decline in healthcare spending largely to blame. The GDP report did, however, state that inflation had risen to a three-year high, prompting some fears on Wall Street that the Federal Reserve may raise interest rates sooner than expected. William Denslow, New York.
There's more from us on Twitter. Don't forget you can interact with us there at Feature Story. And that is the latest Feature Story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Nearly 20 people have been killed and scores wounded in an Israeli strike on a crowded marketplace near Gaza City, according to Palestinian officials. This follows UN reports that at least 15 Palestinians sheltering at a school were killed by tank fire. Israel says it's investigating the claims, but is accusing the militant group Hamas of using schools as bases to launch rockets. Around 1,200 Palestinians and 55 Israelis have died since the outbreak of violence began on the 8th of July. Christian AIDS Policy and Advocacy Officer William Bell has been speaking to Britain's LBC Radio and says providing help continues to be difficult.
It is an incredibly difficult environment to work in, as I'm sure everybody can appreciate. But we are able, through the local organisations that we support, to try and reach some of those who have been most hardest hit. So we're working with emergency healthcare systems. We work with children's psychosocial report. We're working with some of the organizations that we've been working there in long-term development, agricultural relief, who are helping people to access clean water. Because, of course, with the situation as it is, people have been made homeless. They have very little access to water. There are issues with sewage, there's issues with power. So an environment that was already creaking and close to collapse is obviously strained even more now. So we're obviously able to help somewhat, but, I mean, the need is enormous.
Of course, and we saw the dreadful pictures yesterday of that power plant, a main power plant actually being hit in Gaza yesterday. William, Israel often cites, though, that they drop their leaflets, that they give Gazans enough warning prior to any attack. But where are these people actually supposed to be going? Because aren't the UN safe facilities full by now?
Well, I think that's really the biggest problem, and I really can't emphasize enough that I know that is what Israel does, but the reality is that we're talking about a piece of land that is the size of the Isle of Wight and that has nearly 2 million people in it, who many of whom are already refugees. So these people who are being asked to leave from densely populated areas can only move to other densely populated areas. So there really isn't anywhere particularly safe for these people to go. And I think what we've seen over the last few weeks is that actually nowhere is safe. I think that's really the important point to remember, that when these people are advised that their areas are in danger of being bombed, they have very little choice as to where to go. It's not as if they can leave Gaza. That's not an option. So they're moving around in an area which is, as they're experiencing, all being targeted.
Christian AIDS Policy and Advocacy Officer William Bell on LBC Radio. This is FSN Reports. A delegation of Malaysian officials has landed in the Netherlands to hold talks nearly 2 weeks after a Malaysian Airlines jet was brought down in East Ukraine. Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak is set to arrive on Thursday. The representatives are expected to discuss how Malaysia can support Dutch authorities in their investigation into the downing of the flight, which killed all 298 people on board. Our correspondent Natalie Powell is in Amsterdam.
Essentially, the Malaysian delegation is here in a sign of solidarity, really, to their Dutch counterparts, who also lost a very many number of people on flight MH17. Now, the Malaysian delegation does really want to show the Dutch that it is prepared and ready to lend a hand even further than it already has done to the identification process and to the investigation itself. We know that there are 21 forensic scientists from Malaysia that are currently here in the Netherlands helping with that process. But really, the Malaysian delegation wants to know if there's anything more that it can do to essentially help speed that up. The Malaysian health minister gave a press conference earlier in which he said that he predicts that the process of identification could well be finished within about 2 to 3 weeks' time. And of course, that will be welcome news of the families of the victims of MH17, who will then have their loved ones released and they can say a proper farewell.
And Natalie, we've already seen the majority of those bodies of the victims arrive in the Netherlands for that identification process to get underway. And obviously those Malaysian nationals among them. What's the latest on that process?
Well, we've heard from the Malaysian health minister today that around 70 of the coffins that were delivered to the Netherlands from eastern Ukraine have now been opened. There was some 220 that were received, and those coffins are being opened one by one. It's a process that it takes a very long time. It's a rather difficult process. What he said is that essentially it must all be completed before any of the bodies can be released, simply because of the methods that they're using. All of the bodies need to be identified before this process can go any further. Now, Malaysia has given the results of blood and swab samples that it completed to the Dutch authorities. That finished yesterday. They received them all yesterday. But it does say that it's struggling with things like dental records for identification. He also mentioned that there were three Malaysian families, entire Malaysian families, on board flight MH17. And essentially what that means is that the DNA identification process is made a bit more tricky because the next of kin are not necessarily there to give full and thorough DNA profiles.
Anger and frustration over this saga surrounding Flight 17 and that crash site, which rebels are continuing to obstruct access to, just adding more distress for those families who have lost their loved ones.
Well, a lot of anger and frustration, of course. Those international investigators that are in eastern Ukraine, unable to gain access to the entire crash site, which could give them much more information than they currently have and give them many more clues to who was responsible for the downing of flight MH17 and indeed why this happened. But of course, not being able to gain access to that crash site is a very frustrating thing indeed. We know that it is a conflict zone and a great deal of conflict is taking place and therefore stopping the investigators from carrying out a full and thorough investigation. And that's really going to be the main topic of discussion at The Hague on Thursday when the Malaysian Prime Minister meets with his counterpart here in the Netherlands. And essentially their ultimate aim of the meeting tomorrow is to discuss how best to proceed so that they can get those answers that they so desperately need.
FSN's Natalie Powell in a very windy Amsterdam. Now, China's former security chief is being investigated for what the country's state media has called a serious disciplinary violation. Zhou Yongkang, who hasn't been seen in public for months, is the latest high-profile figure to be linked to Chinese President Xi Jinping's so-called anti-corruption crackdown. Cheng Li is director of China Research and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington.
He was a very senior leader, the so-called the member of the Power Bureau Standing Committee, which consists of about 5 to 9 people. these are the people to really run China. And he was also the person in charge of the state security and police apparatus for 10 years from 2002 to 2012. So it was a big event, and certainly enhanced the current president Xi Jinping's popularity and public support that make his anti-corruption campaign very much real. To a certain extent, the corruption is a widely spread phenomenon. So by arresting this heavyweight politician, you can uplift the public confidence of the party. Otherwise, party will be jeopardy.
This is Xi Jinping's broad and aggressive anti-corruption campaign. At least that's how he wants it to be seen by the public. Is this the Communist Party reacting to public anger, essentially?
Absolutely, because the corruption has been a widely spread phenomenon. And you early on, you heard the case of Bo Xilai, and also Minister of Railroad. The guy had a nickname called Mr. 4%. In every railroad deal, he got 4%. And also involved some military senior leaders, basically just sell the position and sell the rank to junior officers, and they get a huge amount of money. Now, we're talking about corruption in China. It's not much of a, you know, like the thousands of dollars or a couple of million dollars. They talk about $1 or $2 billion or even more. This kind of amount, it's not Chinese yuan, but U.S. dollars. Mm. So the corruption is really out of control, and the Communist Party's reputation is in terrible jeopardy. And so therefore, you need to do something before too late. So this is precisely what Xi Jinping wants to do.
And he talked about taking on the tigers and the flies. Obviously, this figure falls in the former. But will this, in your opinion, have a meaningful impact? These high-profile scalps, fundamentally, will they change China's culture of corruption?
Well, this is much harder. And at the moment, the leadership did admit that they are only dealing with the symptom, not dealing with the root cause. The root cause is the system did not fail to prevent this kind of corruption. But this will take time. No country can build up a legal system overnight, and even in a couple of years. It takes longer time, so that's understandable. But after this campaign, this is very much an ad hoc campaign, not based on legal procedure, not based on political institutionalization. But you can buy some time and to uplift public confidence. But you do need to follow up with serious political reform and the legal reform. Now, public is watching whether after a few years that the leadership will really establish this kind of a system, like, for example, leaders' income disclosure and the kind of conflict interest regulation and et cetera. Now, if they fail to do that, you can expect there will be a new wave of the corruption, as you said, it's part of Chinese culture, recent culture. So therefore, this is very, very important. So ultimately, we'll see in next few years whether they will make some solid political progress based on the capital that Xi Jinping received by his very popular campaign at the moment.
Dr. Cheng Li is Director of China Research and a Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington. And that brings us to today's FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, remarkable eyewitness testimony about what happened when the United States dropped a nuclear bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. Dutch van Kirk, the last surviving crew member of the Enola Gay, died yesterday at the age of 93. He was the navigator of the B-29 Superfortress that dropped the uranium bomb, known as Little Boy, on a city of a quarter of a million people on August the 6th, 1945. In the intervening decades, the world has debated the morality of President Harry Truman's decision to use the atom bomb both on Hiroshima, then 3 days later on Nagasaki. But as you'll hear in this interview, Dutch van Kirk was in no doubt that his actions helped bring about an end to World War II. He speaks here with Steve Barnes of Arkansas Educational Television.
I knew that Captain Parsons was going to arm the bomb in flight, and that required his handling black powder back in the bomb bay in order to arm the bomb in flight. I was much more worried about him handling black powder out there back there than I was the atomic bomb.
You'd been told this is not another bomb. You knew that.
Yep.
What was the mood aboard the plane? Was there a mood other than...
Well, the mood was that, hey, there'd been a tremendous amount of money spent on this, development of this bomb. It was our big chance to end the war and save many lives in the process. Without an invasion, without Japanese killing more people in China and everything of that type. This was our big opportunity to do that. Don't screw it up. I was very apprehensive. I didn't want to be the guy to screw it up. I want to make sure I found the right target right on time and everything of that type.
When you were approaching the target, you feel your respiration go up, your heart rate go up? I mean, were you tense?
No, I don't think so. By that time, you're... this is a critical part of the mission. And, you know, if anything, and for me personally, I think when you reach that critical part of the mission, I slow down.
Oh.
And everything else. I try to say now, is this all right? Don't do anything now to screw it up and things of that type. And you slow down whether you want to or not. It's almost automatic.
When you guys took off, they had, I think you were even told, we're not all together, we can't be 100% certain that you guys are going to come back.
That is correct.
I mean, that's on any yep. obviously any combat mission, but given the nature of the armament, there was no guarantee that the aircraft itself, after the explosion, could survive.
We were told by the scientists very early on that we would have to be 9 miles away from the bomb when it exploded, or it might take the airplane with it. So we were working very hard to be at least 9 miles away when the bomb exploded. Now, we knew that when the bomb was released from the airplane, it would take about 43 seconds for it to fall to the altitude at which it exploded.
By the way, what's your altitude there?
We're at a little over 30,000 feet.
Okay.
30,600, something of that type. We knew it would take 43 seconds, so immediately the plane surged when the bomb left the plane. You knew you'd have to make a 150-degree turn, so Paul put it in the 150-degree turn, lost 2,000 feet in the turn in order to build up airspeed. And everybody's sitting there counting. And after 43 seconds, we got a... It seemed longer than that, but anyhow, 43 seconds is a bright flash in the airplane, very similar to a photographer's bulb going off in a dark closet. And then we continued away, and somebody hollered flak. Felt like a very close burst of flak under the right wing or something like that. Tail gunner says it wasn't flak, it was a shock wave, and here comes another one. So then we got the reflected shock wave, not quite as big. First shock wave was measured about 3 to 3.5 G's, which doesn't sound like much to a fighter pilot, but in a B-29 at 30,000 feet, why, it was a pretty good jolt. Then the second one was not as strong, so then we weren't sure we weren't going to get any more shock waves from it, so we made a right left-hand turn to turn around so we could see out the window and see what had happened to Hiroshima. We could make no visual observation whatsoever. The entire city of Hiroshima was covered with thick black smoke and dust and dirt and everything that had been kicked up by the blast. And around the periphery of the city, you could see some fires breaking out. By this time, the large white mushroom-shaped cloud that you've all seen pictures of had already was forming. Everyone wants to know what color. Well, on top it was white, and the stem of it was all colors of the rainbow, purples, reds, and everything of that type. And then we flew a little bit in the southeast quadrant of the city, trying to make visual observation. We can make none. It's just impossible to see any of the city, so we decided we'd turn around and go home.
And Dutch van Kirk is thinking what?
Well, at that time, my major thought was, my land, what happened to all those people on the ground? And, you know, something always goes through your mind and everything of that type. But it was a necessary act of war, unfortunately. And also, the second thought went through my mind, this war is over.
You knew?
I was pretty doggone confident. The only thing I was not confident of, I didn't think the Japanese would even fool around for the second bomb or something of that type. But their warlords and everything thought, based on their atomic program, see, they had an atomic program too. Everybody had an atomic program. Based on their atomic program and the fact that we had dropped the uranium bomb and they were working with uranium, they thought, they only have one bomb. They didn't know we had already developed bombs using plutonium. And all subsequent bombs were plutonium-type bombs. And so we get back, and there was no indication from the Japanese that they were accepting our terms of unconditional surrender. We sent airplanes back to drop more leaflets over Japan. We dropped many, many hundreds of thousands of leaflets over Japan before we ever dropped the first bomb. And more hundreds of thousands of leaflets over Japan before we ever dropped the second bomb.
Could you feel the tug of history at that moment? Or the sense that, we have opened a door. Mankind has opened a door.
We just want to get back to our base and get the free beer.
Yeah.
No, at that particular point, I don't think we had any sense of history or anything of that type. We had been there for, I'd been there for 5 years, and 4 years, really. And, you know, I was getting tired of this war and everything of that type, and we were just want to get the war over with and get home.
And now, you've had 60-some-odd years to contemplate or reflect on.
Well, right now I look back and I say, everything being exactly the same as it was at that particular time, I would do it again and everything like that. You had to remember there were about 10,000 people being killed over there every week. It wasn't so much Americans, because unless we were involved in an invasion or, you know, something like that, our losses were not all that heavy. Yeah, we lost maybe 10 crews a week or something of that type. If an engine had pulled full power and was going down the runway and they'd crash at the end of the runway and everything, but that's relatively insignificant. But the big slaughter was coming apart over in China and Indonesia and everything of that type. And I had the Chinese people today come up and thank me profusely for dropping the bomb, because you know, the people were being killed there, you know, willy-nilly practically. And so basically it was all those people that were going to be killed if the bomb had not been dropped. The other thing about it is, I don't know when the war would have ended if we hadn't dropped the bomb. It would not have been August 14th, I'll tell you that right now.
That's Dutch van Kirk, the last surviving crew member of the Enola Gay. He died yesterday at the age of 93. And he was talking there to Steve Barnes of Arkansas Educational Television. It's the state's PBS station. You can see much more of that interview online at aetn.org. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to contact us, you can by email at reports@featurestory.com and follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Simon Marks with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.